We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined for a special edition of Federalist Radio Hour with my colleague, senior editor John Daniel Davidson. John, welcome.
Hi, Emily.
So we've been wanting to get this podcast together for, I would say, about a month since we returned from our trip to the border in early June. And because, John, first of all, we took hours and hours of footage and audio, and you reviewed all of that to produce two excellent, widely circulated, and I would also just say, like, very moving dispatches from the trip. And by the time we got all of that together, we got the trailer for the documentary we were doing based on the trip out. Here we are.
Now we just need to finish the documentary.
Yes, the minor work of finishing the documentary. Well, it's going to be called Cartel Country, and I think John, as we were batting around a title for that, Cartel Country seemed appropriate because what the media coverage. So the media coverage of the border is already just too little in general. So the media doesn't cover it enough, but it also is completely incomplete is probably one way to say it, because it lacks a focus on the fact that this is a black market for human smuggling that happens a stone's throw away from our border on an industrial scale. And John, you've been to the border many times. What about this trip in which Title 42 was sort of in play? We're about a year into the Biden administration. What about this trip stood out to you?
Well, let me just take a step back for our listeners and tell them what we did. We both, you and I, along with a friend and colleague, David Agron, who's a journalist based in Mexico City, met in Brownsville in early June. This is a few weeks after the demise of Title 42 never happened, right? Title 42, which is the pandemic era health order that allowed U.S. border authorities to quickly expel people that they caught crossing the border illegally because of COVID, was supposed to expire on May 23rd. And that didn't happen. A judge ruled that they have to keep it in place for the time being. And so we wanted, part of the reason we went when we did is to see what the effect of that was, knowing that we're sort of in the middle of an ongoing record-breaking surge in illegal immigration. Each month now, it breaks the record set the month before. So, you know, April broke, you know, the record set in March, and May broke the record set in April. And I know that when we get the numbers for June, they're going to break the record that was set for May, for last month. So, or for May, that we're now in July. See how the time gets away. So we went to Brownsville because we wanted to go into Matamoros, which is across the river from Brownsville. And we also wanted to go to McAllen and go across the river into Reynosa. And so that's what we did over the course of several days, visiting migrant shelters in these places and talking to the people, the migrants themselves, obviously, the people who run the shelters, and also just people who work with migrants in various ways in these Mexican cities, and as well as going to the respite center in McAllen that's run by the Catholic Charities. That's where ICE and CBP discharge migrants once they're released from federal custody. And part of the reason to do that is to dig deeper, as you say, Emily, into the story that the corporate media doesn't want to tell. It's easy to go down to the border and get tragic stories and dramatic images. Literally almost anyone can do it. You just go down there with like a camera and a tape recorder. You will find these heart-wrenching stories of migrants surviving all kinds of violence and abuse and exploitation to get to where they've gotten. And it's easy to kind of get footage if you hang around long enough of migrants being arrested by Border Patrol or being ferried across the river in boats. And I wasn't as interested in that because that story is low-hanging fruit, and it doesn't really get to the heart of what's happening there. Why do hundreds of thousands of people get arrested now every month on the north banks of the Rio Grande? How are they getting to the Rio Grande? What is happening in Mexico? You know, Mexico has immigration laws. They have military style checkpoints all through the country. How are these people getting up through Mexico to the U.S. border and into the U.S.? And how are they being processed, and why are so many being released? Those are the questions that the corporate media doesn't dig into, because the answers to those questions are deeply counter-narrative and counter to the narrative that migrants are victims, the United States is the victimizer and is perpetrating a humanitarian crisis, and that all the migrants are sort of like these virtuous heroes, and that the crisis is sort of the fault of American policymakers. Now, I'd agree with the last part. It is the fault of American policymakers, but not quite in the way that the corporate media says it is. And so, to circle back to the title that we picked for this documentary, Cartel Country, one of the things that becomes undeniable and yet still underreported is that the whole scheme of illegal immigration has been captured by the cartels that control northern Mexico and monetized by them. And this is a new development. Only in the past few years have they managed to do this, such that now all movement over the border is part of this money-making scheme that is enriching these cartels and that is exploiting these migrants and is all made possible by U.S. policies and the lack of the enforcement of U.S. immigration laws.
I want to focus in on your point about migrants as victims, because that was really interesting from my perspective in the way they tell it. At some points, they're talking explicitly about the fact that they're escaping just economic hardship. Yeah. And that doesn't qualify under asylum laws at all. Then in other cases, I'm thinking of Alba Luz, for example, who said her brother was murdered in, she's Salvadorian or Nicaraguan, murdered by a gang. She moved to another neighborhood. It was a threat to her family. And, you know, I think there may have been ransom money involved, pay us, or this will happen to you. So they're fleeing violence, gang yeah. violence, organized crime, but that also doesn't qualify under asylum law. And right. it doesn't mean that they're not facing immense struggles.
Right.
And then they do go on to be victimized by the cartels in many cases, because we talked to however many people who went through kidnappings. And it's maybe more banal than it seems. They get taken into these houses, which are in terrible condition, but they basically just have to get in touch with a relative in the United States who wires them money via Western Union, and then the cartel lets them go. But the asylum law really seems to me to be the heart of the problem.
It absolutely is the heart of the problem. It's the asylum law, and it's also our refusal to sort of enforce the asylum laws. And really, the first part of that is that it's a defective body of law, right, that is not able to account for what is happening now. The average wait time, if you get into the United States and you claim asylum and you begin an asylum case, it will take on average now 5 years for your case to wind its way through the immigration courts and for you to actually get a final decision. Now, the vast majority of people who begin this process do not get asylum. It's something like maybe 15% are granted asylum or less. And if, you know, it's different when you're talking about different for different countries, but for, you know, Central Americans, for people from Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala, it's about 10 to 15%. So the vast majority do not qualify for asylum, but that's not really why they file asylum claims. They file asylum claims because they want to get into the United States and they want to start working. And, if they can do that, they've accomplished sort of their goal. You know, almost all the people that we talk to, and this has been true for like in the past 6 years that I've been going down to the border to talk to people. It's been true that almost everybody, whether they're a single person, a single adult, or they're there with a child or more than one child, they have other family members, a spouse and other children back home in their home country. And they're trying to get in the United States so that they can send money home. And in some cases, they're trying to get into the United States to pay off debts that they incurred to get up to Mexico into the United States, or that their families have incurred with loan sharks back home. So if once they get up to Mexico, to the U.S.-Mexico border, it is imperative for these people to get over the river and get into the United States so they can start earning money, so they can start either paying off debt or sending money home. And it doesn't matter, you know, I mean, many of the people that we spoke to, they were less concerned, because a lot of these people have questions for us as journalists.
I was just thinking when you mentioned the work thing, how many people we talked to at the respite center. We talked to a group of Haitians. We talked to a Nicaraguan family who had been kidnapped recently. John, you went through the immigration papers they had gotten from the United States government, and they were asking
with their permission.
You know, of course, with their permission. And they were asking you, can we work? Does it say anything about work?
Yeah, everyone wanted to know about work permits and wanted to know whether or not the papers that they had gotten from ICE authorized them to work. And the strange answer to that, to my surprise, was that some of them did and some of them didn't. And there didn't seem to be any rhyme or reason as to why. There was a couple, I believe, Ramon and Veronica, mm-hmm. who had a little 2-year-old daughter with them. They had paperwork of a kind that I've never seen before. It was a humanitarian parole, and it had very little information on it. And it was essentially a directive to check into an ICE office in Washington State, which is where they told ICE they would be going within a month of being discharged. There was no like court date. There was no ID number that would allow them to work. It was really sparse paperwork. And then a whole other group of Haitians that we spoke to and reviewed their documents, they had a completely different set of documents. And some of them had court dates that were years in the future, but they had work ID numbers. And so they were allowed to work. And I don't know, you know, if it's by according to nationality or according to what part of the border you're arrested in or what the situation is. And no one else seems to know either. It seems to be sort of an ad hoc, sort of Kafka-esque bureaucratic nightmare. And once these people are turned loose, it seems like there's very little in the way of like government mechanisms to keep track of them or to enforce the laws. I mean, their paperwork says that they're subject to removal. They're in removal proceedings. But they're now in this system that's so broken and so backlogged that they essentially are free for years and years to live and work in the United States, which is their goal all along. And that in turn fuels more people to come, because then they send word back home. We got to Washington State. We got to Florida. We got to Virginia, wherever it is that we're going. And the word spreads. If you can get over the river, you can stay.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free price on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that 6-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those 6-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotion-y feel either. Every set comes with 2 bath towels, 2 hand towels, and 2 washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 1-year limited warranty. Those roll and go anywhere MyPillows. You can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/Federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. mypillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. mypillow.com/Federalist. And what role, you've covered this during several administrations now, what role do you think the Biden administration has played in the confusion that we saw on this most recent trip in early June? Because we have a lot of audio, and folks will hear it when they watch the documentary, of people specifically name-dropping Biden. Some of the migrants followed the news much, much closer than others. Some of them didn't know what Title 42 was. They didn't seem to know who Joe Biden was. But others did pay attention to the news. And it's just remarkable. One of the things we heard that was the most poignant came from Pastor Abraham, who has converted his Bible school into a migrant shelter, a makeshift migrant shelter, basically over the last couple of years. He's been ministering in Matamoros for 20 years. He's seen the evolution of the cartel, the industry, the industrialization of the cartels. And he said he has regular meetings with the U.S. consulate and regularly asks them to have a PR campaign, quote, in plain Spanish that explains American immigration law. If you can get in, if you can't. Yeah. Seems to me, John, the problem is that we can't explain that in plain English or plain Spanish ourselves.
No, we can't. And it doesn't matter even if we could, or even if the Biden administration could, because who are they going to listen to? The Biden administration or their cousin who's messaging them on WhatsApp from Washington State or California after being released from ICE custody, free to work, and to send money home. And we have to understand too, that like the amount of money these people can make in the United States is like 10 times more than what they're making at home. So it's a substantial, in their hometown in Guatemala, the families who have family members sending money from the United States, are living much better than the families who don't. And so there's enormous pressure to get a family member into the United States so they can send money back. So you can, build a new house or buy a car so you can sort of get into, out of poverty and into a middle class life. It makes a huge difference. And it's a very, very powerful driver of illegal immigration. And what we offer on our end is just this confusing morass of ever changing policies and programs that no one, even in our country, can seem to keep track of, let alone somebody who's following the news. Even those, the people that we talk to who followed the news most closely and sort of made some of their decisions about migration based on the news and changes in policy, all of them cited Biden as the reason and said, when Biden came in, he announced these changes and we thought this would now be a good time to go as a result of the things that the Biden administration was saying. We're not even talking about people who, that right after Biden took office, like in the spring of 2021, the T-shirts, the thank you President Biden T-shirts that the people in some of the migrants in the caravan were wearing. Setting all that aside, at this point, the people who follow the news, and I'm thinking of a young Cuban guy named Osniel, who is very up to date on changes to, Title 42 and to the migrant protection protocols, and very sharp guy and seemed to follow the news very closely. He left Cuba. He hired smugglers and got out of Cuba in early April. Because at that time, when he left, the policy was that Cubans would not be expelled under Title 42. They would be allowed. They were not on the list of nationalities subject to Title 42. And so if you could get over the river and you were a Cuban, you would be detained for a few days and then released into the United States pending the results of your asylum hearing. And so on that basis, this guy set out on, you know, he paid a smuggler $11,000, and it took him through Central America all the way up through Mexico and up to the border. And he arrived at the border on April 29th. And what he didn't know is that 2 days before he arrived at the border, the Biden administration announced a new policy saying that Cubans, up to 100 Cubans and 20 Nicaraguans per day, would be subject to expulsion under Title 42 in a new agreement reached with Mexico. And so his timing was just unlucky that 2 days before he arrived at the border, this policy changed. And he crossed the border and he was expelled, and he tried to immediately cross the border again, and he was expelled under Title 42. And when we encountered him in Reynosa, he had been there, you know, for a month or so, and he wasn't sure what he was going to do because he was out of money. He couldn't pay the cartel in Reynosa to cross the border because he had spent all his money, and part of the package that he got for 11 grand was that he got to cross twice, and he crossed twice and he got expelled twice. But clearly for people like this, US policy, Biden administration policies are the deciding factor for them in terms of when they sort of pull the trigger and decide to pay the smuggler and to get on the road to the northern, to the US-Mexico border.
And Osniel told us this remarkable story. And again, it's very difficult to verify. John, you kept making this point over and over again. These stories are almost, yep, they're frustratingly impossible to verify. They're, yep, heart-wrenching and tragic, and probably true in very many cases. But Osniel told us he went outside just to observe the July 11th protests in Havana last year. And the police beat him. He showed us a mark on his shoulder where he was beat by the Cuban police. And that's when he decided to leave. His family is still in Cuba. He's about 20 years old. He's just desperate. He said the situation in Cuba is never going to get better. We talked to people from Honduras who said the same thing was their motivation. It's never going to get better in Honduras. So we might as well take the chance.
That's right. And the same day that we met Osniel, and I wrote about this in my dispatch, our friend David got a call from him that night at about 2 a.m. He had decided, for whatever reason, to swim across the river, and he didn't pay the cartel and he didn't tell anybody. He just left the migrant shelter, which sat on the river. The migrant shelter where he was right on the river, and he swam across the river near the international bridge, and he called David in a panic because he was afraid that cartel gunmen had followed him and had followed him over the river and were hunting for him on the U.S. side of the Rio Grande. Now, David tried to assure him that that was probably not the case because of how close he was to the bridge. It was unlikely that any cartel members followed him over. But nevertheless, David said he would try to get a hold of the police and let them know that he was there, where Osniel was. And, wasn't able to, you know, he got a hold of the local police and they said, call Border Patrol. Wasn't able to get a hold of anybody at Border Patrol. And David kept messaging with him, you know, throughout that night, kind of trying to like tell him kind of where to go to kind of get to a place where he felt where he was safer. And then around 5 a.m., like his phone went dead. And David didn't hear from him after that for 10 days. And he popped up again after 10 days in Brownsville, Texas, and was raising money for a bus ticket to Florida. So he got out of there, but it sounds like just barely. If the cartel didn't pursue him over the river, I think that it's a safe bet to say that the cartel pursued him into the river. And that's why he was so afraid. And we heard, you know, in Matamoros, we heard earlier in our trip stories when there was a migrant encampment downtown Matamoros, people who tried to swim across the river, the cartel would go out into the river and grab people and drag them back into Mexico if they hadn't paid. Mm-hmm. So this is a real, you know, circling back to the title of this forthcoming documentary, Cartel Country is exactly what it is. That the border is under control. It's just not under the control of the U.S. authorities. It's under control it's under the control of the people who run northern Mexico, and that are these cartels that have completely transformed illegal immigration into a money-making scheme, and they enforce it very closely.
Every migrant is a customer of the cartel. And that's one of the interesting things when we were talking to Pastor Abraham again in Matamoros, and that the anecdote you just shared was from the Catholic shelter that we went to in Matamoros, where the director of the shelter told us, he said, we heard from people who crossed and were plucked out of the water by the cartel. So while they're in motion, almost on the shore, they're getting pulled back. And Pastor Abraham told us, basically, that the cartels don't bother him at his makeshift shelter because they aren't harboring customers anymore, because they tell. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, well, because Pastor Abraham is not trying to make money off the migrants.
Right.
But he told us
competition, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He said that if he started charging the migrants to stay at his shelter, if he started charging them for food, if he started making money off them in any way, immediately the cartel would show up at his shelter and say, we want a part of this. We need to be cut in on your profits here. The cartel considers any money made off migrants to be their money, or at least that's an industry in which they are going to get a cut. Because, as you say, they're all potential customers. Now, Pastor Abraham has a good relationship, or not a good relationship. He has a working relationship with the cartel in Matamoros, because he's been there, you know, running his Bible school and working as a pastor for 20 years. And he told us that a lot of the kids who went to his Bible schools as children have grown up to be sicarios for the cartel, and they're in the cartel now. So they know him, and they've known him since they were children, and they like him. And he told us that they know that he's doing good work, you know, that they know the difference between the bad guys and the good guys, and they know they're the bad guys, and they know that he's doing good work, and so they don't bother him. But they don't bother him because he's not making any money off the migrants. And he also asked asked the coyotes and the smugglers not to come to the shelter and sort of solicit business from the migrants there. But at the same time, and this is where he was like, they don't do business here, but he was also acknowledging at the same time, they know that all their customers are here. And I remember at one point I asked him, I was like, well, you know, do the migrants who stay at your shelter, do they engage in business with these cartel members and these cartel associated smugglers? You know, do you hear of them, you know, leaving and being taken over the river? And he said, yes. He said, sometimes they leave and they're gone for a couple of days and they come back because they get expelled and they're like, oh, I hired a smuggler and it didn't work out. Or sometimes they just disappear. And that means that they've gotten over the river with the aid of the cartels. But it's very interesting, though, that he acknowledged that the presence of so many migrants in one place, from the cartel's perspective, is just a concentration of a source of income, potential customers all in one place.
Cartel country. And John, I've been meaning to follow up with you actually on something that Pastor Abraham said, which was fascinating to me. The way he explained this, and again, to reiterate, he has been in Matamoros operating a Bible school basically for 20 years. He's Mexican himself. He immigrated to the United States when he was younger. And he was telling us one thing he noticed is that this started to get really bad under the Obama administration. So immigration pre-Obama was very different than the changes that happened during the Obama administration. And he pinpointed one really interesting thing, which is when Obama changed his policy so that Cuban refugees who touch American soil are not automatically in Florida. You know, they cross, they do that famous sort of story of coming on the raft or the boat and touching the soil of Florida and being granted asylum. When President Obama changed that, Cubans discovered that they could take a route through South and Central America. And this is what created basically an infrastructure through South and Central America for migrants, so that when we're talking to people, cartels have this is a huge business, this like migrant trail basically, and there are multiple obviously branches of it, but there are people who make money as vendors at different points along the trail. Yeah. There are people who are making money as cartel checkpoints. There are cops that are members of the Guardia Nacional who are making money at these checkpoints. It's basically developed into like an infrastructure.
It's a huge infrastructure, and it's not a small amount of money. It's billions of dollars a year. You know, the amount of money that these people pay into this industry, you know, it varies widely. It could be as little as $1,500 a person, or as much, you know, in the case of the young Cuban guy that we talked to, Osniel, $11,000. So, you know, if you just take an average, just say it's $2,000 or $3,000 a head, and we're arresting, you know, 240,000 people a month at this point at the border. So it's an enormous amount of money that's changing hands all along the way. And then once you get up to these cities in northern Mexico, even more money will change hands. Especially if you switch cities and you're dealing with a different criminal group or a different cartel group. Mm-hmm. One of the things we heard over and over, just to kind of emphasize your point, Emily, about how sophisticated the infrastructure is we heard over and over migrants talking about a code or having a code or not having a code.
It's like a serial number.
Yeah, exactly. And which functions like a receipt, right? And what happens is these migrants, once they pay the smuggling organization, they're given a number. And the number is kept in databases that are accessible to the cartels at the points of entry on the U.S.-Mexico border. And so if you start out in Nicaragua or you start out in Cuba or you start out in Guatemala, you're on a certain route that is going to have its endpoint on a certain border, in a certain border city. And the cartel in that border city is going to know whether or not you have paid up because you will have a number. And so when you arrive there, either a local police or Guardia Nacional or cartel gunmen are going to stop that bus full of migrants, either at the bus station or outside the city or at one of these cartel or Guardia Nacional checkpoints, and will ask people for their numbers, for their code. And if you don't have one, they kidnap you. And if you do have one, you show them their number and they have the means to verify that that number is authentic and that you have paid up, and then you're free to go on. And we talked to people who had done that, and we talked to people who hadn't done that. And the ones who hadn't done that invariably are kidnapped and taken to a stash house, essentially where they just have to stay there until their family members can come up with the money and wire it to the cartel. And one of the other things that Pastor Abraham told us is that the cartel doesn't let anybody go from these stash houses until they get their money. And if that means that the family members back home have to take loans out from loan sharks there, then that's what they do. And what that creates is this terrible situation where the migrant who now is free to cross into the United States, from the cartel's perspective, they let them go. And so the migrant crosses illegally into the United States. That migrant now there's a time bomb that's ticking. They need to get into the United States and they need to start working so they can send money home. So their family back home, which is now in debt to some very dangerous people, so they can start paying off that debt. That the loan that they took out to pay the cartels. So it's like a parade of horribles. The whole situation is one of abject exploitation of these people for profit. And it is the only thing that makes it possible is that we are releasing these people into the United States. That is what makes it possible. And that is what the American people, I think, don't understand.
Could you assess the point about the changes during the Obama administration? Because that was really interesting to me, and looking back on it, it does make sense. Him pinpointing the Cuba policy in particular was fascinating. I wonder how influential or how consequential you think that change was.
I think that those kinds of changes are huge, and they have these ripple effects that we don't see for a number of years, right? Mm-hmm. Like the Obama administration, this I think speaks to maybe a lack of imagination or just a lack of creative thinking on the part of policymakers in both parties in D.C. thinking, we have this foreign policy goal that we want a rapprochement with Cuba. And so we're going to kind of rescind this policy that says if a Cuban can get to U.S. soil, and then they can be allowed to stay. We're going to sort of offer the Castro regime an olive branch.
Yep.
Well, the unintended consequence of that is to open up a smuggling black market that involves the Mexican cartels to get Cubans through Mexico and over the U.S.-Mexico border. I don't think anyone foresaw that happening, but they should have. Given, you know, any realistic assessment of Mexico should lead you to believe that if you open up an opportunity for a black market and for criminal organizations to make money, they are going to take advantage of it. They're going to monetize it, and so that combined with other changes to U.S. policy having to do with asylum law, some of which were passed in the Bush administration, mm-hmm. at the end of the Bush administration and then into the Obama administration, having to do, you know, the purpose of some of these laws was to fight human trafficking, right? And so we sort of loosened some of the criteria for initiating asylum claims. This is back in 2008, 2009. And it didn't take long. It was the first wave of unaccompanied minors and Central American families showing up to the border and claiming asylum was in 2014. And you can trace a line from these policy changes to the unmitigated, historically catastrophic surge of illegal immigration that we're experiencing now. And Americans may not follow this stuff, but I guarantee you people who want to get into the United States, who are living in some of these countries, they do follow it. And it only takes a few people to sort of take advantage of changes to U.S. policy and then send word back home, and then word spreads. So, it doesn't matter that in these villages in northern Guatemala or in these towns in Nicaragua or in these Haitian communities in Brazil and Chile, it doesn't matter that those people don't follow U.S. immigration policy. They know what they need to know. And that is, if you can get over the river, if you can get inside the United States, you'll be released in the United States. And that is all they care about.
And let's talk about the Haitians, because they're such an instructive example, I think, of a lot of this. It seemed to me, and I think the numbers bear this out, that we were able to obtain in Matamoros and Reynosa in particular, the Haitian migrants are the biggest percentage of the population.
By far, yeah.
Right, yeah. And you can see that. And, you know, they have this reputation as being kind of hustlers, hard workers. They're there. They're willing to, you know, work at the car wash, work at the fast food joint, whatever it is. But that said, they're a particularly interesting case study because they have been living in countries that are much safer and economically sounder. Maybe they're not wealthy countries, but they're not Haiti. They've since the 2010 earthquake, they've been living in Argentina, Brazil, Chile, even Mexico, northern Mexico, wherever it is. And they are still flocking en masse. We talked to some people who had been in Matamoros, seemingly standing around at the literal border for a year plus, because camping out on the streets, which is literally what they do, and scrounging for their food is better to them than being somewhere else, because it means they have a chance to get into America. So in no sense do they qualify under asylum. They're not in imminent danger. They're in more imminent danger as they camp out in literal cartel country, where some of them, we talked to a guy who was kidnapped in a case of mistaken identity by the cartels. They just want to be in America. period, and they're willing to camp out in cartel-controlled cities for years on end in order to just have that chance, which is why they told us they stood really close to the literal physical border, because at a moment's notice, something they can change, and they said they want to be there first.
Yeah, and the other thing to note about these Haitians is that a lot of the folks that we talk to, you know, this is June now of 2022. A lot of the reason that there's this high concentration of Haitians in northern Mexican border cities is because of what happened in September of 2021, when you had the large encampment of Haitian migrants in Del Rio, underneath the bridge in Del Rio, Texas. You know, Del Rio is across from a city in Mexico called Acuña, and it is not known, has historically not been known as a very cartel kind of controlled area. It hasn't been a big corridor for drug trafficking. It's not one of the more dangerous or sort of lucrative plazas for drug trafficking. And so word kind of got out about that one of the places that you could cross into the United States without having to pay off the cartel tax was in Acuña. And you could go, there was spots to walk across the river safely into Del Rio. Well, what happened in September of last year was that, you know, 15,000 Haitians ended up underneath a bridge outside Del Rio, Texas, in what was quickly turned into a humanitarian catastrophe. And, you know, because the news organizations just love the visuals, right? And this looked like a refugee camp, and essentially it was. And once the news crews descended and these images of thousands and thousands of Haitians underneath this bridge started circulating in the national media, the Biden administration said, we need to clear that out right away. And so what they ended up doing was just deporting a bunch of these people, some thousands of this group of 15,000 back to Haiti. Well, for these people had not lived in Haiti, as you said, for years. They came from Chile, from Brazil, from Argentina, from all these different countries in South America, where they had been living in Haitian communities that were well established, that had been there for years and years. Their nightmare scenario for them was to be deported back to Haiti, a country they never intended to go back to. And we should note that these people had legal status in these South American countries. They had ID cards. Journalist friends of mine who have found discarded ID cards on the north bank of the Rio Grande. As soon as they step foot on U.S. soil, they get rid of all of their ID cards from South America, because that's proof that they don't qualify for asylum, because they already had status in another country. And so, you know, you can go along the north bank of the Rio Grande and collect just dozens of ID cards of these Haitians from countries like Chile and Brazil. So the reason that the reason we were encountering so many Haitians in Matamoros and Reynosa is that the Haitians, more so than any other nationality at the border, do not want to cross the border illegally.
Yes.
Because they're afraid if they get arrested by U.S. Border Patrol, they may be deported to Haiti. And so they are willing to wait it out, as you said, in pretty tough conditions. Even if they're not camping on the streets of Matamoros, you know, the conditions in these shelters are not great either. The shelters are at least safe, but they are essentially walled compounds and like overcrowded villages. But having come up to the U.S.-Mexico border, being so close to kind of like the dream of getting into the United States, these Haitians are not willing to risk deportation, because word spread of that to the Haitian community, the Haitian migrant community, is like wildfire. When, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 of them from that Del Rio encampment were deported directly back to Haiti, what happened there was that as soon as word got out into that encampment that they were putting people from the encampment on planes and flying them to Haiti, the vast majority of that encampment dispersed back over the river into Acuña, into Mexico. They fled because they didn't want to get arrested and deported by U.S. Border Patrol. They didn't want to go back to Haiti. They would rather go back into Acuña and find another way, you know, in northern Mexico, try to figure out a way to get a lawyer, to wait it out, wait for U.S. policy to change so that they can get into the United States legally, even if it's just to sort of claim asylum on a spurious asylum claim that they'll never actually get. Again, that's not the point. The point is just to get into the United States with permission to work. And they're willing, as we saw, to just wait in pretty tough conditions for as long as it takes in northern Mexico. And you know, it's the same. We were in Matamoros and Reynosa. It's the same in Juarez. It's the same in Acuña. If you go to any of these border cities, you will find Haitian communities of migrants that are just waiting. Yeah, exactly.
John, by the way, now if you go along the north bank of the Rio Grande, what you'll find is a drone that we crashed.
No one will ever find it.
We crashed a $40 drone as we were trying to get a shot of the river. We sort of hiked through a little kind of trail and found a place to get a shot. But one thing, John, I wanted to put to you is the most obvious devil's advocate question that you and I both sort of understand. But in light of the so-called pink wave that's kind of sweeping South and Central America, Gustavo Petro, et cetera, the question would be, why doesn't the United States just let everyone in? Vet them for security checks, but these desperate people who have traveled thousands of miles in some cases, and much of it by foot, some of it by bus, horrible conditions, whatever it is, why don't we just let them in?
Well, I have no doubt that that is what the left wing of the Democratic Party, which sort of controls the Democratic Party now, would like to do. And the problem with that is that they have to change the law to do that. For as little as the law may be enforced at the border, there still is sort of the structure of the law within which CBP and Border Patrol have to work. And so even though they may be releasing hundreds of thousands of people into the country, they all are subject to removal. They're in removal proceedings. They just have to sort of go through the system to get to a final judgment of deportation. And in the meantime, many of them just simply abscond, or they stop showing up to their hearings when it becomes clear that they're not going to get asylum, and they disappear into the sort of illegal immigrant underground in the United States, which is vast, right? And it encompasses entire industries of illegal workers. Undocumented workers, I'm supposed to say. I think the argument for, but you're asking more in a normative sense, right?
Like, yes, like yes, yes.
Why don't we just, and I get this question a lot from people who sort of like disagree with me about the border, say, well, if it's true what you say, if the border has turned into a massive industrialized black market, why not? Why not take the black market down by mm-hmm. Why not take the incentives and profits away from the cartels by simply letting in anyone who wants to come into this country? And I think essentially, why not have open borders? And I think that may be a way of thinking of it, or that sort of like proposed solution does not quite take into account some of the things that we're describing with the situation in Mexico and with these cartels. It doesn't matter if we if we release everybody who gets across the river into the United States and give them, you know, work permits and give them temporary status or give them legal permanent resident status or make them citizens. That's not going to erase the black market in Mexico. It's not going to end the exploitation. If anything, I think it would make it much worse, because you would get if we think there's a lot of people coming now, if that sort of a policy got out, we would be looking at not hundreds of thousands, but millions of people coming to the border, per month. We'd be talking about, refugee or migrant encampments, not of 15,000, but of 150,000.
From everywhere.
From all over the world. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I don't think it's workable. The other thing that I'll say is, if we're going to talk about this from a normative perspective, from what we should be the case, our immigration laws and our border policies should serve the American people first. That should be the number one consideration when we think about what policies we should have at the border. The United States has, even if we did perfectly enforce our immigration and asylum laws, we have the most generous, the most liberal immigration regime anywhere in the world. If you try to cross the border in another country illegally, you'll get shot, you know, and not just in China or North Korea. If you try to run across a border and enter another country illegally, in most parts of the world, you will just get shot. And I'm not saying that's what we should do here, but I'm saying we need to understand in context what it means to have a border policy or immigration policy and a border security regime, and how far outside the norm the United States already is. Our immigration laws have not substantially changed since 1965, when they introduced sort of family migration, or what they called now chain migration. We don't have immigration system that's based on sort of the needs of the American economy, that's based on a need for workers, or that prioritizes the economic health of the United States. And I think that from a normative perspective, that is what other countries do. That is what most other countries have always done. The idea that we owe the world entry into the United States is a utopian fantasy, and it's a dangerous one that creates, as it is already doing, enormous amounts of misery, exploitation, and violence on our southern border. And to the extent that we buy into that and propagate that way of thinking and promulgate those kinds of policies, we will see a deepening level of violence and misery and exploitation at our border that will make what we see, what we have now, seem like nothing.
Hmm. John, is there anything we didn't cover from the trip that you think we should make sure to mention?
If we didn't cover it, we will cover it in the documentary.
Yes, it'll
which
be
is
there.
Coming out later this month.
Okay, so then my last question is, as we're sort of gearing up for a Republican primary, it could go in many different directions, there should be a conversation about what a Republican administration, since basically we right now have open borders via the administrative states, the regulatory regime. In a new Republican administration, Republican president, we can even include Congress in this. What are policies that you can think of that would be pretty big solutions to what we're looking at right now?
The first thing I would say is that you have to have a Congress and a White House that are willing and able to work together to actually change law, to change the law. And especially to change asylum law. We have to fix the sort of the backlog that we have. We have the most insane system you've ever heard of. But we have to get stricter with asylum, not just with granting asylum, but even initiating an asylum case. That is an incentive that's so powerful that drives as a draw factor for the rest of the world, you know, knowing that if you can just get into the United States and initiate asylum claim, you can stay. What did we see when the Trump administration instituted the migrant protection protocols, the Remain in Mexico program? Suddenly that incentive was taken away and the number of illegal crossings plummeted. Mm. You know, people respond to incentives. One of the most frustrating things for me is watching the corporate press cover the migrant crisis and the border crisis, is that they treat migrants like they don't have any agency.
Yes.
Like they infantilize migrants who undertake these epic journeys that like none of us would probably survive. Right. So obviously these people have incredible amounts of agency and grit, and they're smart and they're savvy and they're survivors. And they're smart enough to understand that if there's not a reasonable chance for them to get into the United States, they are not going to go into debt. They're not going to put their family in debt. They're not going to sell their house and their farm and everything they have to pay a smuggling organization to get to the United States. They won't do it.
Endure kidnappings and any kind of violence they'll almost certainly encounter along the way.
Exactly. They won't they won't take that risk. So we have to return to a policy of deterrence. And we saw different forms of that during the Trump administration. We have to deport people. The message getting back to these sending communities and these sending countries has to be that if you try to get in illegally, you will not be allowed to stay. The only people that are allowed to stay are those who come in through legal channels. And that will require an overhaul of our immigration system. It will require, drastic change in policy in the meantime. It will require the kinds of programs and policies we saw during the Trump administration. Not that any of those were perfect, and not that's what we have to sort of replicate or bring back. But that way of thinking about the border and that way of thinking about migration and having sort of like a modicum of respect for the agency and the wherewithal of the migrants to know that they do respond to incentives. And if they believe that our policies will let them into the country, and if our policies actually do let them into the country, then nothing will stop them. Nothing will stop them from coming.
Hmm. John Daniel Davidson, senior editor at The Federalist, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Emily.
Make sure to watch Cartel Country when it comes out. We'll have more updates for you as we get closer to the release. We're working on editing it right now. There's a lot of just incredible, I think, conversations. And you get to hear from all of these people we've talked about, all these characters, Pastor Abraham, Alba Luce. You'll hear from all of them, see them, and you can make up your own mind when you hear from them. So that'll be out soon. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We'll be back with more soon. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
I heard the faint voice of reason, and then it faded.